Welcome back to the MHP podcast. I am happy to introduce that we have Dr. Chris Pagel with us, and he would like to introduce himself and how long he's been in the Asheville area.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pagel. My family and I have been in Asheville for over 10 years now, entirely with PML pathology. I did, as well as my general training in anatomic and clinical pathology, I did a fellowship in cytopathology at Duke University. And cytopathology is the discipline within pathology where you go into great depth in studying fluids, fine needle aspiration, and rushings, which includes pap smears. And then, so I'm the director of cytopathology at PML pathology, and I oversee the HPV testing that goes on there. So I'm well equipped to handle this podcast and answer any questions that may arise, hopefully. And thanks for having me.
The topic of today's conversation is cervical cancer screening. How did this all start?
So there have been lots of kind of recent changes to some of the general guidelines in cancer screening from both the American Cancer Society and the United States Preventative Services Task Force. So I think this is a great time to talk about this and to educate providers about these changes and just make sure that both patients and providers know that these changes are out there, because cervical cancer screening is a huge success story and it's great that they're tweaking it even further.
How has it evolved over time?
So cervical cancer screening started mainly in the 1940s with you know, the famous pathologist George Papanicolaou, who came up with the Papanicolaou stain, which uses multiple different dyes in a fixative, typically based with ethanol, that allows for great examination and nuclear detail of the cell, which allowed pathologists to pick up on these pre-malignant changes that occur before a cervical carcinoma, a cervical lesion becomes invasive. And so that debuted as early as the 1940s. Screening recommendations really picked up in the 70s, and they've been incredibly successful. I can't emphasize how successful cervical cancer screening has been. It's been more successful than other cancer screening attempts. Risk of death reduction has decreased 90%, whereas in, you know, colorectal and mammography or breast cancer screening programs have reduced risk of around 40%. So it's been incredibly successful. The incidence of cervical cancer early stage has decreased from 9.8 to 4.9 cases per 100,000 between 1976 and 2006. These successes have come with kind of incremental improvements of the screening, both in terms of the algorithms that people are following and in terms of technology. So I mentioned in the 1940s, we had the Papanicolaou stain. And then in the early 90s and 2000s, we have liquid-based cytology, which is something I think is underappreciated as a technological breakthrough. So you used to have to look at these horrible, difficult-to-interpret smears of pap smears, where it's just spread all over the slide. You had obscuring blood and mucus. Liquid-based cytology, which in PML we use ThinPrep. Another vendor out there is SurePath. But anyway, it presents the cervical sample on the slide in this monolayer, concentrated circle. It lyses red blood cells, get rid of the mucus. So it's just a lot easier for the pathologist to interpret the slides and see these very important pre-malignant conditions. So that was the early 90s and 2000s where that came about. And that's also very useful for fine needle aspiration biopsies, where you don't have to look at a big smear of the thyroid. You can look at it concentrated on the cell in a monolayer. So shout out to liquid-based cytology, which is kind of underrated. And then in the early 2000s, I mean, we've known for a long time that HPV was the causative agent in the majority of cervical carcinomas, but HPV detection started to become a player in the screening guidelines as early as the 2000s.
So can you tell us more about the pathophysiology of HPV and how that has changed how we screen for cervical cancer?
HPV is a double-stranded DNA virus. It has over 200 genotypes, sometimes referred to as types. And within those 200 genotypes, there's 14 that are considered high risk, meaning they're known to cause cervical carcinoma. And the way this works is, so HPV is spread by direct contact. It's highly transmissible, easily spread, and it infects the basal epithelium of the squamous epithelium of your cervix. So it affects those basal cells preferentially at the transformation zone, near the junction of the cervix and the endocervix. And how it works is it replicates two viral oncoproteins. And this is kind of, it sounds overly detailed, but it's useful to know this stuff when you think about how the different FDA approved platforms work. So it produces two viral oncoproteins, E6 and E7. And then these oncoproteins disrupt normal tumor suppressor genes in the cell, and replication just goes unchecked. It's kind of like cutting the brakes off your car. You can't hit the brakes anymore. You're just flying down the road. So anyway, that's basically how it works. But it's important to point out again that even if you have one of these 14 high risk genotypes, most of the time a healthy immune system will fight back, and these even high risk HPV strains won't have any effect or any harmful effect on you. And they can be often transient.
What are the benefits of us screening for HPV primarily versus just the pap smear or the cytology that you had mentioned?
Right. So as I said before, I think HPV is responsible for 90% of cervical carcinomas. So obviously that should make it a likely target of screening. And the hole that primary HPV testing is filling is that if you look at the people today that still get cervical carcinoma, the big group, half of them, are people that just are not getting screened, the people that unfortunately still get this disease. And then another big group of people that still get the disease were people that got only cytology without HPV testing, because cytology is very specific, but it's not very sensitive. And then you can think of HPV testing as being the opposite. It's highly sensitive and has a very high negative predictive value. The other benefits of primary HPV testing is that while cytology detects your immediate risk, like immediately what's going on, HPV positivity might tell you more about your long-term risk if you're a continued carrier of a high-risk genotype. And then also, primary HPV testing is thought to be more reproducible than some of the subjectivity involved with cytology. And so given all that, in the U.S., primary HPV screening was FDA approved in 2014. It hasn't completely picked up popularity. There are concerns, namely over the increased sensitivity causing unneeded colposcopy. And also people have concerns that, you know, there's still a big chunk, 5 to 7% of squamous cell carcinomas that are thought to be unrelated or HPV independent. And because these are not detectable by testing for HPV, they often present in advanced stages.
With that, how does that change our screening guidelines? Since we have a test that is highly specific, but not as sensitive, but a highly sensitive test that is not very specific, how do we choose, or how do we pick? What do we do?
There's an option, and which is very popular today by the United States Preventive Services Task Force. So from ages 21 to 29, they recommend still that you get cytology every 3 years. And that's because in this younger population, HPV is very common. You don't want to have too much testing and increased cost. But then from ages 30 to 65, they have recommended in the past an HPV and cytology co-test, where you get both done simultaneously, and then you manage the patient based on those results for ages 30 to 65. Recently, the American Cancer Society was kind of the first to adopt and really promote primary HPV screening of a cervical cancer clinician collected as their kind of preferred screening method of choice for ages. The difference is they recommend starting at age 25, whereas the United States Preventive Service Task Force recommends starting at 21. The ACS's preferred method would be primary HPV screening of a cervical sample collected by the clinician. And you could get that done every 5 years. The other valid options would be a self-collected. There are some testing platforms. There are really two main ones on the market now that are FDA approved for self-collected vaginal samples. That would be the Roche Cobas and the BD OnClarity are two platforms that are FDA approved for self-collected vaginal samples. And then the one PML Pathology uses is a slightly different assay, which is FDA approved for primary HPV screening of cervical clinician-collected samples, but not self-collected samples.
Do we have enough data to know whether the self-collected samples have been as good as the clinician-collected samples?
Yes, the task force have concluded that the data is strong enough to make these recommendations, although they do say that the patient's collected samples, you have to get that done, get that tested every 3 years. And I think the main goal with these task force and allowing for the vaginal self-collected samples is that they want to hit that group that's never been screened, and they hope that it'll increase the screening. I'm a little doubtful that people that aren't following up with their clinicians and aren't seeing physicians are then going to be very rigorous about getting themselves self-collected samples and getting that tested every 3 years. I think that's a stretch. I don't know if you think that the self-collection model will increase screening. Do you think it will? Or
so I know that a lot of insurance, well, Medicaid specifically, is trying to increase the screening. And so they're looking more into these self-collected options and providing them to the patient. So then that way it would just kind of increase the amount of preventative care that we can provide to these patients. I think that it is a tough age group because if we're looking at the Medicaid population, that age group comes on and off of Medicaid, and that age group also is the primary caregiver of the children in the house. So being that said, a lot of times they put their healthcare behind all the other family members in the home. Where we are finding that we have that gap in care is that they come on and off of Medicaid, doesn't follow the year. It also kind of cycles between whether they're in pregnancy or not in pregnancy and kind of where they fall in that economic time frame. But a lot of our goal is also to increase their annual wellness checks, which would also increase their information about having screening, which hopefully would then impart that they might consider if they weren't going to undergo a clinician collected sample, maybe they would consider doing a self-collected sample. I know that there have been successes, granted it's not apples to apples, with the Medicare population doing the self-collected stool samples for the Cologuard, for example, to try to improve colon cancer screening. So I think they're trying to do some of the same strategies of this is part of the population that hasn't gotten screened. What can we do to improve their screening? And a lot of times, I think the insurance companies are willing to send the kit to their house to try to improve their availability to them.
I hope it works. I just like you say that I'm just not sure in this population that I'll have the same success. But for the providers, I guess they should know that that's not the preferred method, even recommended by ACS. The preferred method is still a clinician-collected cervical sample for primary HPV screening. And then acceptable is still HPV and cytology every 5 years or cytology every 3 years. So it's still not preferred. And then another issue I have is that the HPV screening platforms that are currently FDA approved for self-collection test for HPV DNA, and whereas the Hologic Aptima platform tests the mRNA of the E6 and E7 transcripts. So they tell you more about if the virus is actively replicating those oncoproteins, and that has resulted in studies showing increased specificity of the Hologic assay, which I think is important for a test that's already overly sensitive and less specific, because there's going to be a ton of people with positive HPV results, and then they're going to have to go on to make an appointment with their clinician, and it's going to be the same issue with following up and getting care that we have with that population.
With the self-collected sample, so if they get a positive on that, would the next step be that they would have a clinician collected sample to get more specificity on it, or is it to then, what would be the next step if it was to be positive?
They recommend the next step is to make an appointment and to see your physician provider.
Right. So once they come to the back to the, if they got a self-collected sample, they come back to the provider, would the provider be then asked to just do, to get a more specific test and do the cytology before going to colposcopy and going further down the testing just to repeat the exam essentially?
Yeah, the management is a little out of my scope, but that's my understanding, that they could then do further testing as such as cytology or even colposcopy if they thought it was clinically indicated.
As we know, as clinicians, the only way to necessarily prevent cervical cancer is that we pursue HPV vaccination, which is what we are also working on the younger group. And I say it just so then that way we can reiterate that HPV is transmitted on both sexes. And so then that, yes, we do cervical cancer screening. However, carriers are not just females, carriers are male and female. And so then a lot of our prevention is also encouraging before our younger population is sexually active, having them get the HPV vaccine to prevent transmission of HPV.
Correct.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Craigle, and all the good information. And we'll hopefully hear more education from you in the future.
Sure, no problem. Anytime. Thanks for having me on.